Hey, this is Dave Douglas, and that is, of course, Sonny Rollins on saxophone. We're listening to Sonny Rollins because on this episode, I'm going to speak with Jeff Caltabiano. He founded the Sonny Rollins Bridge Project, which is moving to get the Williamsburg Bridge named, get Sonny Rollins' name added to the Williamsburg Bridge due to his all the hours that he put in playing the saxophone on that bridge. And Jeff has a lot more to say about different parts of the world and different kinds of music. Fantastic guy, fantastic conversation. Greenleaf Music depends on subscribers and people who come to visit the platform. And we hope that when you hear this podcast and all of the different episodes, you'll want to come and get more. At greenleafmusic.com, you can subscribe and hear all the different artists, and all of my records are there. So please do, please come by. That's what I'm going to say. All right. So here's some more Sonny Rollins, and we'll talk with Jeff. Thank you. Jeff Caltabiano, it's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for making the time.
It's so great to be here. It's really a thrill. You've been a hero of mine for 20 years. So,
well, see, I didn't know that. And then I only found out that later. I learned of you through the Sonny Rollins Bridge Project.
Yes.
And then found out that you'd been stalking me for 26 years.
That's me. Quietly stalking.
Well, right. And that I'd never met you, but that you sent me a list of gigs that you'd seen, and some of them were like one time only bands.
Yeah. Yep. Been closely following your career. I first saw you at the Knitting Factory Hollywood, I think in the year 2000.
That's right. I played in Hollywood, right? It's not important.
Mm-hmm. Saw you there a couple of times.
Thank you, Nagin. So I just wanted to ask, I mean, I find the Sonny Rollins Bridge Project so impressive and so important and so challenging. It would be great to have that monument to him in the city. And I know there's just, it's been a real struggle, and you know, how many signatures do you have now on the petition?
We're over 13,500.
That's a lot. Is that more than you? Is that more than you expected when you first went into it?
Yes. It has taken some time. You know, we've been at this for a few years, but I'm grateful to each and every single person that took the time out to sign that, and have also read all the comments that people have written. You know, all the people that have shared it. And, you know, there are folks such as yourself. You've been really great about certainly sharing that online and on Twitter. So it's been definitely a team effort. I'm sure, of course, it would be great to have more signatures, but I'm very impressed that all of those people, believe in this project.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that anybody that listens to this will now go and sign that, because it, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of ways of looking at it, and what does the naming of anything mean? And also the constituents in those areas that are adjacent to that bridge mm-hmm. should have some sort of say. But I mean, yeah, I'm sure that every time you go over that bridge, you can imagine Rollins up there practicing.
And that was really kind of one of the sort of impetus for this project was that I lived for 13 years, about 2-3 blocks from the entrance to that bridge. And I knew the story and I would daydream. I would, every time I walked over into Williamsburg, I would, you know, imagine that Sonny was going to be around just that next bit. And, you know, I would listen for his sound. And you know, it is a sacred space in music. I imagine that others also hear that sound. 13,000 of them also hear that sound. And that's what this is all about.
But can you recap the story briefly for anybody who doesn't know it?
Sure. Like
what year did he first go up there to practice?
So details are a little, some of them are a little mysterious, you know, or a little unclear, but the summer, late summer of 1959, Sonny Rollins decided that he needed to take a break from playing publicly, which meant recording, playing gigs. And so he took approximately 3 years off, and approximately 2 years of those, he found the Williamsburg Bridge, which he lived nearby, and he would go practice up on that bridge. He claims, you know, almost every day, sometimes up to 14, 16 hours a day. And did that for, about 2 years. So probably the fall of 1959 to like the summer of 1961. But if you know anything about jazz, you know, 1959 is considered, and I'll be careful with my language here, it's not the best year in jazz, although some would say that is, but I think in terms of modern jazz, it is the most pivotal year in jazz. And, you know, I think that's kind of undisputable. And so for him at 30 years old, you know, really the peak of his career, to step out and to say, you know, I'm not going to play, I'm not going to gig, was kind of career suicide at the time.
It sounds a little bit like lockdown, to tell you the truth.
Except, there are a lot of parallels.
Except we all had to walk away to Correct. Our own private bridge.
Correct, absolutely.
What makes you say 1955 is the most important and pivotal year?
1959, the year that he stepped out.
Right.
Because there were so many great records that came out that year. Uh-huh. You know, Mingus put out what I think are his best records. Three of them, you know, Dave Brubeck, Time Out, came out that year. This little album called Kind of Blue by Miles Davis came out that year.
I've heard of that.
And you know, the other thing that happened, the sort of shot heard around the world was that the Ornette Coleman Quartet performed at the Five Spot in the fall of that year. And supposedly Sonny Rollins was at a couple of those shows. And many people would argue that, you know, that sort of changed the course of jazz for really up until the present. So much happened that year. So again, won't call it the best, but I will call it probably the most pivotal year. So, you know, among all of those things, among all of this fantastic music happening, Sonny Rollins decides, I'm going to stop playing. So,
well, you know, not stop playing, right? He was playing every day.
Yes.
Sometimes up to 14 hours.
But not performing, not, you know, basically his wife supported him financially for those years. And he decided to really kind of disappear from the public eye. I guess that's sort of the you know, there's been some folks have picked up on this with Andre 3000, where he sort of disappeared for a few years. And, you know, and this is, you know, I think the other thing that's interesting about this is that, you know, to hear a musician these days, you know, go 5 years between a record, if you're a pop musician or rock musician, that's not uncommon, you know, and it's not uncommon to sort of, you know, not be heard from. But for a jazz musician, and for a jazz musician in 1959, and certainly someone of Sonny Rollins' stature, that's, you know, understanding that context is so important. And I think the fact that, you know, what he did during that time, and you corrected me, an absolute in the spot on, which is that he was still playing, right? He didn't stop playing. He just decided, I'm not going to record. I'm not going to perform for anyone in public. And that, I think, is what's so interesting in the fact that he did it on a bridge. You know, he did it on this massive bridge in the middle of New York City, you know, his home. He was born in Harlem. And, you know, I think there's so much, yes, there's definitely some romance about the idea, you know, it's permeated into popular culture. I mean, The Simpsons did a whole character based around Sonny Rollins playing on the bridge, which was Bleeding Gums Murphy. Was based on him. Lisa hears Bleeding Gums Murphy in the middle of the night playing on a bridge. You know, that came from Sonny Rollins. And so, you know, I think that sort of just the idea, this idea of him alone on the bridge, mostly alone. He did perform with some other folks up there, practice, I should say, with other folks up there. But that, I think, is what's so interesting is, you know, there's, you know, to think that this man who was at the top of the jazz pyramid at that point just said, you know, no, I need some time out and I'm going to go on this bridge and practice.
Well, there's also a deep philosophical meaning and value to it for him, obviously, and something that he's talked about, that it was beyond just a musical practice, but a practice in the sense of a spiritual practice and a learning. And I think I can imagine feeling like you want to go to a new place and that being busy and traveling and doing shows all the time isn't allowing you to get there. And I can imagine doing that. So on the far end of this hiatus, 1961, the summer, what was the first gig that he came back to do publicly?
He played, it was the Jazz Gallery, which is different than the Jazz Gallery we know today in New York City. But yeah, he played there with Jim Hall. And I don't remember who was on bass and drums. Might've been Bob Cranshaw on bass. But yeah, and that was his return. The New Yorker did a piece about his return. That's really spectacular, where he talks about what he did during that period. And you can find it online called Sabbatical, because that was considered his first sabbatical. And he took two sabbaticals, two famous sabbaticals in his career.
That's great. Did he go back to the bridge much? Like, let's say, during the 5 years immediately following the initial sabbatical?
That's a good question. To my knowledge, no. There was a documentary that was made about him called Who is Sonny Rollins in 1968. And he for that, they basically recreated the sabbatical. So he went back to the bridge. And practice there with Paul Jeffrey. But other than that, I don't know. I mean, he did move from the Lower East Side pretty soon after 1961. He moved over the bridge, into not quite Williamsburg, but near where I believe Pratt is.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and he lived there he lived in Brooklyn for about a decade.
I guess that would be Fort Greene now.
Yeah. So I don't know if he went back to the bridge much, but you know, I do know that at least for that documentary, he returned, And then interestingly, I think in this mid-70s, they did a commercial based on the idea, a Panasonic commercial. But it was actually filmed on the Brooklyn Bridge because whoever the director, producer was, thought that it might be, you know, a little bit more romantic to have the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right. It's built of stone, so it's a little more picturesque.
Yeah. But what that's also meant is that has been that there's confusion over which bridge he performed on. And the number of people think he performed on, or practice, I should say, on the Brooklyn Bridge, when in fact it was the Williamsburg Bridge.
Right, which is also much more isolated, the Williamsburg Bridge, much less foot traffic, probably in 1959.
During that time.
So I just want to move on. You sent me a couple of just beautiful and fairly unusual, well, not often heard Sonny Rollins tracks. But since you've spearheaded this movement to get the bridge named for Sonny Rollins, which I support and I know a lot of people support, what is it, you know, what brought you to feel the need to start that movement? People can go and read about it and follow the progress at sonnyrollinsbridgeproject.com, I believe. Mm-hmm. But you know, what was it that you said, okay, I need to put this in motion and fight for this? And maybe in the larger sense, not just related to the bridge, but cultural monuments in general.
So there were a couple of things going on. One of them was that, you know, I had been in New York, as I had mentioned at that point, almost a dozen years, had gone to so many jazz concerts, but didn't feel that I was kind of part of the community, and felt that I had gained so much from jazz music, and I wanted to give back. So that had been percolating in my mind for a bit. I knew about the story, you know, and as I said, had daydreamed about hearing Sonny or seeing Sonny as I crossed the bridge. And then one day, the Ken Vandermark, who had hipped me to Sonny Rollins' bridge work, his after the bridge work, about 15 years prior, had posted a photo of the Williamsburg Bridge and said, "It's still Sonny Rollins' bridge to me." And at that moment, I just had this aha moment. And I said, "Oh my God, he's right. Someone needs to rename this bridge." And so that's sort of where the idea started. And I had spoke to some people about it, said, "What would this take?" You know, didn't get quite a clear answer on what it would take. And then I read one day, I think it was in February of 2016, a letter to the editor from Sonny Rollins himself to Jazz Times Magazine. And they had written an article about civil rights in jazz. And they had listed a number of pieces by Mingus, by Roach, by Abby Lincoln. And they didn't include Sonny Rollins' Freedom Suite. And so he wrote them this eloquent letter saying, you know, "You've overlooked me here." And he gave a whole history of that. You know, what led him to write the Freedom Suite. And he said, you know, this was the first full, you know, civil rights themed album in jazz. And, you know, I don't want to be overlooked. And his last line was, "I just, you know, I don't want to be overlooked by history." Mm-hmm. And I could tell, I could sense in that he was assessing his career, his legacy. I could sense a little bit of depression, if you will, or, you know, sort of frustration. As we know, Sonny Rollins can't play anymore. And I said, "Oh my God, like, I have to do something." Like, you know, he's worried that he's going to be written out of history. You know, Sonny Rollins, the greatest improviser that we've ever known, you know, thinks that he's going to be written out. And so it was at that point that I decided, you know, I've got to make this happen. So that was the sort of, you know, my personal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the larger experience, you know, and the larger sort of idea behind this is that there are very few public monuments or public recognitions of jazz music in New York City. And if anyone knows their jazz history, you know, with a couple minor exceptions, you know, New York City has really been the center of the jazz world for quite some time now, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, depending on how you slice it. And yet there's so few, there are private sort of, there are certainly private recognitions of it. You know, you've got jazz at Lincoln Center and you've got the Village Vanguard, but there aren't any public or very few public. And so that sort of concerns me, that bothers me as somebody who's traveled Europe and seen monuments to musicians and writers and artists all over Europe. You know, we don't do that here. And that's really unfortunate. And so, you know, in the case of the Sonny Rollins Bridge, you don't even have to build a monument, right? It's already there. The bridge already exists. Mm-hmm. All that we're asking for is that they add the name of Sonny Rollins to the Williamsburg Bridge, not replace, right, but add it to the Williamsburg Bridge.
That is so cool. Cultural monuments, they mean a lot. They validate, and they also just are a constant reminder of where we come from and what is the lineage and the tradition here and what was important. And so I just think it's so great that you're doing that. There is Thelonious Monk Circle, and I think Miles Davis Way, and I mm-hmm. think Duke Ellington has a street, and I saw an Ella Fitzgerald Road. I think it's in New Jersey. So sure. Like street names, no problem. But a major bridge, a little more work. So,
yes.
But congratulations for putting it together. It's so brilliant. You sent me a track from 62, which I guess would be a year after the hiatus. And this is the quartet with Billy Higgins and Don Cherry. They play this fragmented version of St. Thomas that is just so phenomenal. Thank you. Yeah, it begins with that incredible Billy Higgins solo, and then continues on into this version that I probably heard it years ago, but I wasn't really familiar with it, of St. Thomas with Don Cherry, and it's really broken down. And I know from your Twitter feed that you're really into photographs, well, from all periods, but from that period, and mm-hmm. collecting album covers and collecting old and new music.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, do you see that as the same thing as your appreciation of all this wonderful music?
Yeah. So, you know, I think to borrow a phrase, I'm an aesthete without an art, right? I am not a musician. And so I don't have an instrument to play, you know, music to compose. I'm not a writer, so I don't have the words to talk about these things. I'm not a journalist. I'm not an artist, so I can't paint. And so for me, you know, in order to sort of share my love for these things, since without those tools at my disposal, you know, I grasp on to photography. I grasp on to the sort of the visual arts, you know, whether it be poster art, or, you know, art in general. You know, there has been I'm really interested in the manifestation of jazz through art and the ways that those arts have been combined. You know, Sonny Rollins, actually, there's a story that begins that he was performing, he was practicing in a room, in an empty room in the late 50s with nothing but a piece of art by an artist named Judith Lindblom. And, you know, that's always really struck me, that he was essentially playing to a piece of art. And so, you know, for me, again, since I can't write about it and I can't write music about it, you know, in order to share what really interests me, it's through that visual culture. You know, and I mean, I'm always, it also kind of takes you back, you know. I kept concert tickets for 25 years, right? So just to be able to look at that ticket and say, oh, I remember that gig, you know. Unfortunately, paper tickets don't exist as much these days, so that's hard.
Right. Right. You need to save them in your Apple wallet.
Exactly. But that's sort of, you know, the ephemera of the performance, and, you know, all the other things that are involved really interest me. And, you know, certainly, I mean, I really love cover art. So, for example, I've learned about some artists through a lot of covers that I've seen. You know, Stephen Byram has graced many of your covers, you know, mm-hmm. and I love his work. I bought some of his work. Mm-hmm. I bought Judith Lindblom's work, you know, and I learned about them through this music.
Wow, that's really cool. And if people aren't following Jeff already on Twitter, I don't know how you do it, posting all those photographs, old and new, but it's Jazzy Jeff, but Jazzy with one Z. So it's JAZYJEF. That's his Twitter handle, and it's a fun follow. So check Jeff out. And another thing that you post a lot is pictures of the Virgin Islands, where I know you spent some time and you did some really crucial work. You sent a track from the band Midnight that maybe I'll play a little bit of, and then we'll talk about what you've been doing down there.
And it's in Lansing, weather the storm, weather the storm. Persevere, I don't go home. Even if our finance are messed with the farm, you will find say, love will share what it have. Xavier, I listen, I see Almighty God. We need more joy, not sorrow, connect. I find it's the feeling that you get and reflect. Oh, it is a level when a balance takes it. When a corporation takes it, it says, hey, I listen and see, hey. Weather the storm, weather the storm. Persevere, I don't go home. And this is the sea, I weather the storm, weather the storm. Persevere, I don't go home.
I listen and see first Rasta man from healing from beginning. The original root of King David, crown him the king of all kings. For he is exalted high upon the wings of the wind. For he is in the valley of the shadows of him who caused us to win. So I and I chant on Babylon and heal him forever. 72 nations bow down in recognition of the harp and the scepter. For he is the lion and the lamb, meridian balancing swing. For he is prophetic and fulfillment, scripture word until, yeah.
And this is the sea,
wow, that is so great, and the lyrics are so poignant and spot on and political. And
yeah, Von Benjamin is sort of considered, one of the great lyricists in reggae. Unfortunately, he passed, I think, 2 years ago, but he was the head of Midnight, and they sort of reconfigured and were renamed Ake Beka. So you check out all their music. Really, they were really prolific band based in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I would hear their music, particularly that song, which was on regular rotation, driving around in my Jeep in St. Croix. I lived in St. Croix for a year and then St. Thomas for about 3 months, 2018 into 2019. In my drive into work, I'd listen to WSTX. I'd rise to the righteousness with Ross Isaiah. Shout out to him.
So in the righteousness, what work were you going to do, Jeff?
Yeah. So I went down there I'm an urban planner is my background. Went to school for urban planning.
Wow.
And spent 15 years in the nonprofit world, doing a variety of things. And then Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, unfortunately. And so I began working in disaster recovery for the city of New York as a consultant. And then took some time off, started this project. And then, the hurricanes hit in the US Virgin Islands. And I do long-term recovery versus I'm not there to clean up right afterwards.
Or throw paper towels, for example.
Yeah, exactly. But we tend to do, as a planner, I do longer-term recovery, so usually with HUD funds. I got a call to, be a consultant over there. And about 6 months after their two hurricanes hit, they got hit. One island got hit pretty badly, and then the other island got hit 12 days later. So I ended up going to the Virgin Islands and stayed for about 15, almost 16 months.
Just day to day working long term recovery, that must have been such a scene of devastation and suffering.
It was. I mean, I was by that point, a lot of the debris had been cleared, we still saw a ubiquitous presence there, were blue tarps on so many roofs, on so many homes throughout the islands. And yeah, so that was a constant presence. And, and you know, yeah, a lot of people were struggling. A lot of people still are struggling.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it was, yeah, you always sort of knew living there, you know, that that this threat had come in and that people were still dealing with it, the aftermath.
And yeah, they still dealing with it. And you look at Puerto Rico, too. It's just, oh, what a tragedy. So were you sent randomly to St. Croix and St. Thomas? Or did you choose, because of your love of Sonny Rollins, to go to St. Thomas?
You know, it's a good question. It just so happened, you know, that I got this call, and frankly, I didn't know much about the U.S. Virgin Islands at the time, aside from St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. So no, it was just by chance. But I will say, you know, one of the musicians that's worked with this project, Eric Lawrence. You know, we spoke about this, and I said, you know, it's just really interesting that I ended up over in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And he said to me, he said, well, maybe that was Sonny's gift to you, you know, for a thank you for starting the project. And that really, you know, that really touched me for him to say that. But it was really good timing, I think, just to sort of, you know, for me to having been so immersed in Sonny Rollins to be there. You know, very unfortunate incident, obviously, but you know, good for me to be able to experience Sonny Rollins, and, you know, his family. His parents were, one was from St. Croix, one was from St. Thomas. You know, although he never lived there as far as I know, you know, certainly to know that he had a connection to that place meant a lot to me to be there.
Yeah, that seems like an incredible coincidence. When you got that call, you must have sort of done a double take. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's great. And I mean, like, so you're there for almost a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it was around 2 years. It was before lockdown. So two or three years ago where you started traveling. I guess you left the Virgin Islands and started traveling international festivals following artists that you were interested in, and just spanning the globe, almost like a music sabbatical. And I would see you in these strange, you know, locations where I would least expect it. You saw a rainout gig that I had in Lausanne, Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Where we were supposed to play in the Gothic outdoor plaza, and then the big storm came on and they moved us into the cathedral, which was like, yeah, no problem. Yeah, fine. It was great.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I remember seeing you at that one. But then I realized that you were traveling, like following all sorts of musicians, and you sent me a track of Abdullah Ibrahim that I actually didn't know to sort of demonstrate all the different ways that you're following. Let me just play this a little bit. What, tell me what is this from specifically?
1975. The track is called African Herbs, and the album is also called African Herbs. And this is just with a fantastic group of South African musicians. I believe Basil Coetzee's on it. And a few others. And this was the first Abdullah Ibrahim album I heard. I believe I picked it up on tape in Zimbabwe in 1996 when I was studying abroad there. And just, you know, totally fell in love with Abdullah Ibrahim.
Wow. You get around. Thank you. That's a great track. Thanks for sending that over. So, yeah, you just mentioned that you were in Zimbabwe in grad school in the 90s. So we're not going to go revisit that in the conversation, but you've traveled the world a lot. So this whole idea of traveling all over Europe, going to jazz festivals and taking pictures.
So I've taken kind of two big trips to Europe, one in 2017 and again in 2019. The first time I went about a little over 2 months, and the second time for 3 months. And both times I was able to catch some festivals that I hadn't really planned on going to. I went over to Finland to see the Pori Jazz Festival in 2017. Also saw a couple gigs in Paris, or a few other places. And then I did a lot more music in this trip in 2019. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, didn't really have too much of a plan. There were some countries I wanted to hit, some cities I wanted to hit, but I kind of let the music guide me, so followed you to a gig because I heard, saw that you were in Switzerland, so looked up to see where that was. There were a couple other, so many festivals in Europe over the summer, so I think I ended up going to all or part of, I think, six or seven festivals while I was there. Also went to, made it to a bunch of clubs as well, Ljubljana, Budapest, went to a couple clubs, various other places. It was a blast. And again, didn't really kind of improvise the trip. I think part of what has changed in me, really since this project, is to live a little bit more in the moment, to kind of improvise, and not to be, even though I'm an urban planner, to not overly plan my life and my travels, and to just kind of go with it. And I've learned that from the music.
Hmm. Right. So you leave the wildflowers and you leave a few weeds here and there in your urban true. Planning. Amazing to have had the resources to do that. I'd imagine that you probably weren't camping out. So it's also just the fact that you were able to take that time and do it, especially in light of the shutdown that came on,
but sure.
probably less than 6 months after you came back.
Yeah.
So that's really amazing.
When I left New York, to be clear, right, I'm not independently wealthy. I put all my stuff in storage. I had all of my.
I wasn't going to add. I wasn't going to go there, but go ahead.
and I put everything into a storage unit, and so that really allowed me to afford to be able to travel as much as I did. I was without a home for 3 years.
We want to know, how does one go about doing this?
Yeah, so I basically just decided, I was ready to leave New York at that point. I kind of, for the first time in a very long time, decided to just kind of live without a net. I didn't have a home. I had all my stuff in storage. I just kind of went with it. And it was scary, and it was also very thrilling. And again, it's this sort of idea of just kind of improvising, and improvising my life and it led me to some places I never imagined I would go. And it led me to see some things and hear some things that I never imagined. And that's because, I didn't have anything kind of holding me down, like a permanent job or a permanent home, and even when I went to the Virgin Islands, I didn't know how long I was going to be there. I didn't know how long that contract was going to be. And so, I was able to, and that's, again, just, it's this sort of idea. I told my brothers a few years ago, for so long I've loved jazz, but I've kind of decided to live jazz, and sort of live this, this jazz life that, you know, which I thought was sort of a, you know, I didn't quite know what that was before, but now I have a better understanding.
And I think Duke Ellington said it best in this clip about dreaming that you reminded me of.
Where did you get your ideas from?
Your ideas? Oh, man, I got a million dreams. That's all I do is dream all the time.
I thought you played piano.
No, this is not piano. This is dreaming.
So great. It's fantastic. Spot on. I wanted to talk to you because you have all these different facets and different interests, and I feel the same, you know, as an artist, as a whatever we do, there's always a million parts of it, and they all intersect in different ways, and then we have our family lives, and we have our collegial lives, and our job lives, and our artistic lives, hopefully. And, you know, it's all an improvised continuum. And I know you're still continuing to collect and think about art and share your experiences along the way. There must be some current, you know, emerging artists that you have discovered and found and maybe want to talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's so interesting because, you know, a lot of people sort of peg me as a, you know, just a jazz fan, but there's so many types of music out there that I love. I love reggae, love Brazilian music, both from the 70s and 80s all the way up to the present. I'm really into Brazilian music. You know, I love African music, the music of Zimbabwe and South Africa and West Africa, you know. So to me, it's all just music, right? Like there's not, and the musicians that I gravitate to tend to not be defined by a genre, tend to not be, you know, boxed in, you know, and I mean, you know, you think about a musician like a Joshua Abrams, you think about a musician like Melvin Gibbs, right? Try to put those guys into a box, right? I mean,
no, we all fight against the box in our own various ways.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they would smash your box, right? And here's the thing. If you try to put them into a box, that makes you a square, right? Like, so
well played, sir.
So, you know, those are the kinds of, that's the kind of music, and I'm not going to say jazz, I'm not going to say, you know, rock. Nice. That's the kind of music that I gravitate towards, right? Is that sort of, you know, I love music that's about collaboration. You know, I love, I think it's really interesting right now, particularly what's going on with some musicians that have worked with Brazilian musicians. You know, Rob Mazurek's been doing that for quite some time. He lived in Brazil. I love his collaborations. You know, Jamie Branch just did a gig with Elza Soares, who is a legendary musician. You know, Ben Lamar Gay has done some work with Brazilian musicians. You know, I'm really interested in that right now. I think, you know, the direction they're going. You know, and here's the other thing, and this kind of goes back to my travels, right? What was so interesting for me, and what really broadened my palette, I think, as a listener, was to hear music played around the world by musicians who aren't necessarily from the country where that genre right, takes hold, right? So for example, I was in Lima, Peru, and I went to a jam session on International Jazz Day. It just so happened it was International Jazz Day while I was there. And there were all of these Peruvian jazz musicians, and they're all, you know, they're all really good.
Yeah.
You know, and to be in other countries, and you know, I was in Budapest, I went to another jam session, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not just, it truly is, particularly jazz music, is there's a universal language there, right? And I know that's a cliche to say, but I've seen it, you know. I mean, here's the thing, like I went to a lot of clubs and a lot of festivals in countries where I didn't speak the language. But yet when that music started, mm-hmm. right, not only were those musicians communicating in a language that I understood, but in a language that everyone in the crowd understood, right? Mm-hmm. And so that person sitting next to me, who I could not speak with or could speak very poorly with in my terrible accent, you know, we now had a connection, and we now, you know, there was something in that music that connected us. And so that to me is what's really interesting. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, it's not just New York anymore that's the center of the jazz world. It's not, you know, Los Angeles has a great scene. Chicago has a fantastic scene. But go beyond the borders of America, which is where this music derives. Mm-hmm. You know, and London obviously is now a hotbed for so much music. And in London, you know, you have so many backgrounds. You have so many people from, you know, it's Shabaka Hutchins grew up in Barbados, right? Mm-hmm. He's got that that Caribbean. You know, he brings that into his music. Mm-hmm. You know, and now Johannesburg is really a hotbed. And I certainly have a deep connection with the music of South Africa and Zimbabwe. And so, you know, those are the things that I'm really interested in. So it's kind of hard for me to say, you know, I could give you a long list of music that I love, but I think I think it's just everywhere, and, you know, and it's all available too. That's the other thing, you know.
Well, this is this is where the box ends. This yep. is where the box becomes meaningless, is when you're sitting at that table and you wouldn't be able to communicate to your neighbor in any language, but just the fact that that music is happening, whatever that music is the thing that bridges our, you know, our connection as humans. Not to over analyze it or anything, but I, you know, the box that you talked about is the nemesis of almost every musician I know. Yep. And you try to outrun the box, and then they find a bigger box. And so, you know, hopefully eventually, what was the thing that when you put something in the box, then you're a square, I think, right. is super spot on. But, you know, hopefully we outrun the possibility to have a box
right.
that could box anybody in. And actually, you mentioned Jamie Branch, and there's a perfect example of somebody who's wide open to all sorts of sounds, and original sounds, and, you know, I mean, in the 90s, people were arguing about, is this jazz? I mean, I guess in the 1920s, they were too. So I don't see that argument so much anymore, because every musician is so free to do what they want to do. And it's what you're talking about here. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, last week there was a spat over whether Mary Halverson is a jazz musician. You know,
that I didn't see that spat.
So. Well, you're not missing anything. But, you know, yeah, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, are we really having this conversation, right? And you know, in my mind, whoever's starting the conversation is someone I just want to ignore. You know, that's the square. If they're trying to put, you know, a musician into a box. I mean, if there's anything you know about the history, particularly of jazz music, it's that, you know, it's the Trailblazers. That's, you know, I mean, think of how many times Miles Davis, you know, changed this music, right? As Les McCann said, it's invitation to openness, right? Mm-hmm. Openness is where we want to go. Like, that's stay open, you know, have big ears, right? Have a big appetite for this stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, certainly, yeah, certainly don't box people in. So that's the music. You know, I know that's a very sort of generic answer, but you know, if you get on my Twitter, I'll certainly give you lists and lists and lists of musicians that I love. You know, yeah, you mentioned Jamie Branch. She's one of the last gigs that I saw, which was in February of 2020. Yeah. And her band is just tremendous, you know, mm-hmm. and she's got a cellist in the band. And thankfully we're seeing more and more cello, I think, in jazz music. Yeah. You've certainly had it in your music, you know, over the last 20 years. But you know, I think, you know, it's a great time right now for cello. And I think it's a great time for, you know, I think it's a great time for trumpet. You know, and I
it's
think
always it's a great time for trumpet.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, cello, you know, and cello. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much. I want to go out with some Jamie Branch, actually. But just thank you for joining. It's fascinating, the story of what you're doing. Once again, everybody, Sonny Rollins Bridge Project is the place to go to support this effort. And a lot of it is going to take local politics and elections. And, you know, it's a very complex process to slap that name up on that span, which is what we would like to see happen. So
we'll get there.
Great. Jeff, thank you
so
much.
I can't wait to cross that bridge with you, Dave.
Like, yes.
Someday I'm going to cross the Sonny Rollins Williamson Bridge.
With a whole bunch of trumpets and a whole bunch of cellos.
And saxophones. You. Come on.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Great. Thank you so much. Great
Thank
talking
you.
To you.
So grateful.
We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this Greenleaf Music podcast, A Noise from the Deep. And it's been a great conversation and great music. Thank you, Jamie Branch, for taking us out. There's an extra where Jeff and I talk about the actual Sonny Rollins piece, The Bridge. So check that out by subscribing at greenleafmusic.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.